Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akil. For today's episode, I have a very special guest. When I started this podcast, I already had a list in my head of people I wanted to come on, and Launus Bonoma was always on that list. He's an agile management consultant, and naturally, we talk about all things agile, especially when it's implemented wrong and how you can fix it. Don't forget to like and subscribe when you're on YouTube and follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Enjoy!
Welcome to Beyond Coding, a dive into the world of successful people in IT. From your sponsors, Zebia, creating digital leaders. Here's your host, Patrick Akil.
Hey, Lawrence. How's it going?
There. Awesome. Doing you great.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for coming on. I already told you before the show, when I started this podcast, I wanted you as a guest. And now 40 episodes later, here we are, 40 or something. So I'm really excited, actually. Really excited to have you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Makes me wonder, though, why you want me as a guest.
Yeah. I mean, you've always left an impact on me whenever we had a conversation. It was mostly you presenting something and me attending and listening. So it always stuck with me, the way you present the things, the content of the presentation itself, and also kind of the visuals around it. I mean, I know you do sketchnoting and stuff like that. It's kind of out of the ordinary, and it always stuck with me. So that's kind of the awesome. Gist of it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I invited you on to talk about, well, first and foremost, kind of organizational change. I know you work a lot with kind of upper levels of management when they want to introduce change, whatever that might be. It's different flavors there, I guess. Mm-hmm. But why is there organizational change in the first place? There's always something that might go wrong within a process. Then you come in and you shift that. But why do they need you in the first place? Why do they need help?
Well, if there's any constant in business, then it's change, right? Yeah. So there's always organizational change, and a lot of people have become a little bit tired of that forever change. The change happening most often nowadays is the shift from more plan-driven approaches to a flavor of agile.
Yeah.
Scrum reigns supreme there, but there's many other agile flavors and frameworks as well. And they usually it boils down to the level of change speeding up. So there's more change happening faster than ever before. That, of course, is a mantra, right? Because they've been saying that for 2,000 years, that everything speeds up all the time.
Yep.
And we've now moved into a level of speed where essentially what happens is we know less than we do know. So we're in a complex environment. And the sad truth of a complex environment is that even if you want to, you cannot plan your way out of that. You have to act your way out of that. And that, of course, is where agile frameworks come in, because they're heavily focused on helping people essentially do the best work of their lives. That's the main focus. That is the good part of it. Mm-hmm. And now leaders, of course, they usually focus on the outcome of that, which is getting lots more work done in little to no time and it being all spot on, everybody happy, right? So we get more for less and everybody's high performant and all that stuff. And of course, if you do it well, that's what happens, but you have to really do it well.
Exactly. What is kind of the biggest change? Let's say we go from an organization which is very plan driven, very heavily based on that in fundamentals, I guess. And they notice that working agile just works better. They just don't know how to change it. Mm-hmm. What is kind of the first thing you tackle when you advise kind of the upper management layer when you come in within an organization?
Usually it's the notion that in a sufficiently complex environment, it's logical that there's more than one top priority thing.
Yeah.
So it's perfectly okay for there to be 10 things that are equally important and they all need to happen. And sadly, they can't happen at the same time.
Exactly.
And that's where it becomes problematic, because now management needs to really do their jobs, which is prioritizing.
Yeah.
Saying, okay, so from all these number one things, these equally important items, let's start with that one. That's the most one-ish one for now.
Yeah.
And that always leads to really big discussion.
Yeah.
Because arguably the other ones are equally important, right? So this is the real challenge. It's not that it's crystal clear that this is the top 10. Everybody always first tries to create a top 10 list of some sort, or a top 40, or to be completely honest, usually it's like the top 1,000 or whatever the number of stuff is that we want to get done. Because one of the other truisms is there's always more work that you can ever get done.
Yeah.
that is, those two combine in a pretty horrible way in most organizations. So there's always more work than we can ever get done. And most of it needs to happen right now because it's really important.
Yeah.
That doesn't ring true to many people, but it is, right? So that's the challenge of management.
Yeah.
We have these really important things that we want done. We have a limited capacity to do so because we just don't have an infinite amount of people. We can't pay for that even. Therefore, we must make choices. But whenever, whatever framework we use to make those choices, it's still really hard.
Yeah.
It still boils down to a human in the end making the choice between equally scoring items.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating.
Exactly. I don't think that choice is within one team, right? It's probably within within one person. I think it's probably within a team there. And different people will probably have different stake in the game. They want different items to be more first than the other first items.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's not an individual problem, right? So because to be fair, I'm an Agile coach.
Yeah.
And I've been so for the better part of 21 years.
Yeah.
If you look at my backlog, you wouldn't expect me to be an Agile coach, right? So I have a hard time making my personal choices.
Yeah.
Now let's take that problem that we all know, because most people have a hard time making their personal choices.
Yeah.
And then amplify it by it not being just your choice, but depending on the choice you make, it's your job on the line.
Yeah.
Plus the people working for you.
Like a ripple effect.
And your boss is screaming in your ear that this is really important and must absolutely happen. And there's 10 other stakeholders that have proven to you that their thing is also really important.
Yeah.
So now you have a humongous list. No real reason to sort through it other than you surviving.
Yeah.
And there's no real personal problem there. It is an almost mission impossible.
Yeah.
And that mission impossible is what we nowadays ask our managers to just go fix, just go scrum on this. And that is a little bit oversimplifying the problem.
Yeah, exactly. But let's say once you have that prioritized list, right, after numerous amounts of discussions, you really have the actual number one.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything below that is probably prioritized to some degree. So which means you can start working on your biggest problem. Well, at least that's what you think you'll do. What's the next? You just go ahead and try and solve the one by one, or?
Well, if only we could.
Yeah, right.
Usually what happens is making those decisions takes such a long amount of time, a long time, that when we start work, we've already started working on the other 8 or 9 or 10 or maybe even more items.
Yeah.
Just in case, right? Mm-hmm. So we can't have wheel spin, so we already started. And it's really hard to stop once you get started. So what happens more often is we've now identified the number one. It took us 3 months.
Yeah.
During those 3 months, we started work on item number 2 through 50.
Sure.
And then it becomes logical to not drop everything, but first finish some things. Or let's start work on number one and also continue the work on the rest. And that is where it goes wrong. Because for true focus, you really need to work exclusively on the most important thing and only work on item number 2 if you can't work on number 1.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. So organization wide, usually you'll end up working on like 50 initiatives. If you're a big corporation, that should be doable. However, we always try 102, right? Or more. And that always leads to humongous amount of waste, lots of waiting, and it becomes logical to create intermediate steps, right? So let's do some design and let's have that ready for when we need it so that we can work on it. And before you know it, you'll essentially have sped up your plan-driven development process instead of really changing it for something more fluid.
Yeah.
And that's the main thing that I see go wrong, that even though we know the theory behind this, even though we know the experience behind this, because all the companies that manage to do so effectively, those are the companies we admire, right? So it's Google, it's Apple, it's Tesla, it's like the big ones, right? So it's also in market cap. So they arguably won with their business model and their approach.
Yeah.
We want to emulate that, but it takes a real, almost superhuman effort to take the logical consequence, to take the next step and actually say, let's stop adhering to the plan.
It feels like we're optimizing for the future, right? To make the future endeavors more smoothly or less of an endeavor if we put in the work now. But that just means a lot of context switches, a lot less focus, right, on getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
And then that number one priority all of a sudden doesn't become number one anymore because everything has kind of that equal priority again.
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially, you're increasing your queue of options,
exactly,
your pool of ideas. And that sounds like a great plan, but it also makes you lose, you don't see the forest for the trees anymore.
Yeah. Right?
So you have just too many great options. And because there's many people involved, it's really hard to make a tough choice. So the choice becomes even harder because now we have more, what's it called? We have more inventory, right? So an inventory of ideas, a big list of stuff we can do. And that tends to keep us stuck in prioritizing, reprioritizing, planning, replanning, spending even more time there.
Yeah.
And that is wasteful because, again, you cannot plan your way out of a complex situation.
Exactly.
You have to act. So it doesn't really matter if the number one thing that you work on actually is the number one.
Yeah.
It's that you're working on one of them.
Exactly.
That's the main thing. And that is also a really hard lesson. So time spent identifying the most important thing is actually time wasted.
Yeah.
It's better to just think, oh, so these 10 are the tough choice. Good. Let's pick one and go.
Yeah.
Instead that's of actually
endlessly
better.
Arguing.
Yeah. Exactly. And that is, funnily, where the structure that we have for plan-driven environments could help.
Yeah.
Because usually those kinds of choices go way easier if you have some hierarchy. So you see that happen in all the agile scaling frameworks. That's the, essentially what they do is they create some hierarchy in there.
Yeah.
They have one person to make those decisions at several levels. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty classical approach to exactly that problem, right? So overload of choice, one person to make the choice.
Yeah.
And then the rest to just get after it.
Exactly.
And that, interestingly, is still a great solution.
Yeah, so, that's effective.
Yeah, it is. However, it would be best to have a conversation around it instead of me just doing blindly what you're telling me to, right?
So that's what I thought.
If I understand why this is the choice.
Yeah.
And then, but the reasoning behind why is it not any of the other 9 equally important things? It's because that could be because, right? Because we have to start somewhere and this is as good a place as any.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you keep mentioning kind of waste in that the planning and kind of the decision-making might lead to waste as well. But I think that's how it works. The reason why people are doing that is because they feel that otherwise it's a waste, right? If they're not working on everything or not working.
But that is such a common misconception because it's the planning that is wasteful because it doesn't really get you a better answer.
Yeah.
The more you plan on those 10 equally important items, the more you'll discover that they're actually equally important.
Yeah.
So the main thing you could have done is to just get going on one of them because now at least we've gotten something done.
Exactly.
And that is... that's really, really the main thing in what I coach people in.
Exactly. So you make them understand that acting is more important sometimes than those endless discussions, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter if it's A or B. We're going to do both anyway. Priority shouldn't matter that much. So let's pick one and just go ahead and do that.
And don't get me wrong, right? I just finished a book on agile project management, which is like... the dark side of agile because everybody says, oh, you shouldn't do projects anymore. But I'm a recovering project and program manager. That's what I used to do before I got bitten by the agile bug. So I have some empathy for the planners, right? So I used to do that. That was my thing. And I know that planning is essential. It's really good. It's very awesome to do.
Yeah.
But I also know from experience that if you keep planning instead of executing, you're not getting anything done. So the planning in essence is wasteful. So the best way to go about planning is to do as little of it as possible to just de-risk you getting started. And essentially the main thing you're planning is, okay, so I have these assumptions. What can I do to validate them? And how can I structure that in a short cycled way so that I know fast if my assumptions are correct or not?
Exactly.
And that usually boils down to either implementing Scrum or some other short cycled approach.
Yeah.
Because in MBA terms, that's what Agile is. It's short cycled steering, which is essentially just deliver frequently and check if what you delivered was the right thing or not.
Exactly. So instead of planning completely for the future, you make sure that feedback cycle is as fast and as frequent as possible. Mm-hmm. So you can still steer left or right, whatever it needs.
Yeah. So essentially to make the assumptions that you're making, not that much of a risk.
Yeah.
That's I stole that from Wilbert Sala, who was a good friend of mine. And I really loved the way that he approached that. So really de-risking the assumptions that you're making.
Yeah. Which makes sense. And then that is, I think, the biggest shift in kind of that long-term planning versus short-term testing your assumptions and shifting whenever you need to, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whenever an organization realizes that and they're like, okay, we need faster feedback. We need that agility, right? Those short iterations, they probably adopt a framework, let's say it's Scrum, and that gets rolled out over the how do you say that? The people that do the operations.
The poor little minions.
Especially if we're talking about upper levels and lower levels. Mm-hmm. I don't really like those terms, but those give me the best mental image. Therefore, I'm using them. But the people that put in the work, they need to then adopt it. And I've been in a team that adopts it, and not everyone likes it the same as others do.
Yeah.
People are against it, even maybe out of...
Yeah, there is a sad truth to the whole Agile thing.
Yeah.
It's now, Agile has grown up, right? So it's more than 21 years old. So they're adults, they can go to a bar and have drinks and stuff.
Yeah.
And one thing that happens is it also leads to general adoption. So companies that actually don't get it are now implementing Agile.
Yeah.
And one of my pet peeves is that there's actually a missing line in the Agile manifesto.
Okay.
That should have read experimentation over implementation, or maybe even better yet, invitation over implementation. Because how Agile used to be done was several teams discovered, this Scrum thing looks awesome. Let's try it.
Yeah.
And they tried it and had great results. Then management asks, wow, how come you 10x your productivity all of a sudden? Explain this to us. And teams explained, this is what we're doing. This is how you could help. And management that got it, that's how it got started here at Xevia as well.
Yeah.
The XSD, that's how the teams worked. It was their thing. It wasn't being pushed on them.
Mm.
Now, the sad truth, of course, is if you push a framework, even if it's an awesome one, on somebody who doesn't really need it, and I'm talking to data scientists here, right? Because they're suffering through lots of completely unnecessary Scrum implementations.
Yeah.
Then you quickly discover, either you restructure the teams so that it makes sense for them to use Scrum.
Yeah.
Or don't force them. And that's really the main thing. Never force Agile down somebody's throat. Make it work for them by having discussions and inviting people to get to know it. Now, what happens in most organizations is they're used to implementing stuff.
Yeah.
So they buy this new framework and they buy some consultants with it, and those consultants come in and they work for the managers, and their assignment is make me Agile.
Exactly.
And that's essentially where the ramrodding begins, because the way they make people Agile is by telling them, this is how you do it. This is what you need to be doing, instead of presenting it to them as an option, something to make the work better, and driving it with the core question of all improvement, which is, what is holding you back from doing the best work of your life?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's process, and then Scrum could be an awesome thing. Sometimes it is something else entirely. It's management listening to you, and then Scrum could also be an awesome thing. So yes, I'm selling Scrum here a little bit, but that's Scrum done right. Scrum done wrong is much more prevalent, and that boils down to, you're going to do Scrum and you're going to love it. And then, of course, you hate it immediately, right? And I see a lot of teams suffer through that they explain to me, I don't like the Scrum thing because now all of a sudden I have to be at work at 9 a.m. because we're having a daily Scrum. And we do that using the same three lame questions. I always then point out, look, you do know, right? It's your meeting.
Yeah.
You can have it anytime you want, as long as it's the same time of day. And you don't have to use the three lame questions. It has to be your huddle as a team. Yeah. What do you do as a team the coming 24 hours to get better at like achieving the goal? If you don't have a goal, let's start there.
Yeah.
And if it's not a goal that you can work on as a team, let's fix that, right? So maybe we're not the right team. All those things can become apparent by doing a really awesome daily Scrum. And that's why it needs to be for the developers, by the developers. Nobody else should be involved, not even a Scrum Master.
Yeah. You touched upon a lot of things, first and foremost, kind of how it works when it's from the ground up, right? Mm-hmm. Because those people, I think, understand the fundamentals, right? This is a cool thing. This can really help us in effectiveness or achieving our goals, or even help set them and then achieve them, versus kind of that top down level, right? People that look at our companies, what are competitors doing? Are they more agile? Are they adopting this thing called Scrum? It's working great for them. Mm-hmm. Let's also do that. And then it comes in top down. All right, we now have to do this as well. And I think there's just a mismatch in understanding then, right? Because the people that follow through and actually need to do it, they're like, why, right? Really just not on a fundamental level, understanding why this can be effective.
Yep.
And this is one of the options, right? Because they're only getting presented the one option, And exactly as you mentioned, someone says you're going to do something, you're probably going to push back and say, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, because you don't understand why. And that's actually where it should start.
Yeah.
Now, all organizational change tends to be driven by bottom-up implementation.
Yeah.
And top-down guidance. So you need both.
Yeah.
So you need management to understand why we're even doing this and how they can be helpful.
Yeah.
And you need the people to understand why management would want you to even do that and how you can be helpful, but also that it's a journey of discovery. Mm. And that is like a lost art in agile implementations.
Yeah.
Because whenever that happens, it becomes, here's your template. This is your structure. This is the rhythm you're going to work in, instead of discovering that together. And the whole point is to discover a better way to work together. That is what agile truly is. So the minute it feels like somebody forces it on you, it is the dark side of agile.
Exactly. Yeah. The other way sounds so much fun though, when you call it an experiment, right? Get people excited, get people hyped from that group with the shared interest of doing that experimentation. And obviously if you prove it works, people are going to be like, oh, what are they doing? Should we also do that? Or they can have that dialogue, right? It's always an option then, instead of it being the only one option. And I think that's, I mean, exactly how you laid out, that's usually how it goes wrong.
Yes.
How do you get people from ground up really excited to do that, basically? Because that's where it needs to start, right?
Well, usually by pointing this out to them.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they want you to work in this way. Yeah. Do you know what's behind that? Yeah. Have they invited you to this? Or does it feel like it's being forced on you?
Yeah.
Usually they say, well, it totally feels forced.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even know that I was supposed to contribute to this. That's what I take back to the people usually hiring me, because I'm one of those consultants, right? So to be completely honest, I'm probably guilty of forcing Scrum down several people's throats. That's how I learned that that doesn't work, but also how I learned to talk to executives, because the executives usually don't do this out of malice. Mm-hmm. They do this out of, and I say this kindly, incompetence. And it's not that they're incompetent as leaders, but they have learned to lead using a different paradigm.
Yeah.
And a paradigm shift is one of the hardest things to pull off, right? So to go from, I need a plan and a budget and a business case for everything, to I just need a little bit of a plan and a little bit of a budget and a little bit of a business case and let's go. Let's get after it.
Yeah.
That's a big change. And also it's a change that flies in the face and is completely contrary to how most companies are actually run, right? So they're run with yearly budgets and that's really risky for an executive to then all of a sudden ditch all that.
It's scary.
And it could really cost you your job. Of course, if you succeed, it'll cement your job for like the next decade.
Yeah.
But it's really easy to fail, especially because you're doing this for the first time. And that's what tend to not be empathetic about enough on both sides, right? So executives tend to expect their teams to just get it and get after it and just, you learn Scrum in 2 days and then of course you're a perfect Scrum team. That's not how it works. You need to learn how to do it, usually by failing. And failing quite significantly. Now, I'm not very much in favor of saying, I'll celebrate your failures, right? So I'm actually against that, because failure is probably not something to be happy about. But accept failure as part of the learning process.
Yeah.
So instead of me looking at you thinking, why did you do this wrong?
Exactly.
Figure out why we have a system where you can do that wrong, right? So it's still, we're zooming in on the error, but we're learning from it collectively.
Yeah.
And we're saying we all the time instead of I or you. If that happens, you become a team. If management also does that, we really become a team. And that's the essence of what Agile was all about to begin with.
Yeah.
To act as a team.
Exactly. I think always failure is part of the process, right? You take risks. You're not going to nail it the first time, probably. So you fail and you learn from that, right? Get up as a team. Figure out what went wrong and try again. Try until you actually get it right in the first place. But I'm not involved in those upper management layers as you've been, but I feel like, and this is my perspective looking from down up, I guess, that failure is not really safe in that environment.
Well, interestingly, it is, because I see a lot of leaders failing quite interestingly in leading their people, right?
Yeah.
So even there, failure is a given. Everybody knows this, but it's really hard to hold each other to account to this.
Yeah.
Because we're used to essentially cutting them off at the ankles, right? Instead of saying, How come that you are able to make this mistake in this system that we create all together? Because you should, it should go both ways, right?
Exactly.
So if you're supposed to look like that to the teams, we should also look like that to our management teams. And one of the, one of my pet peeves is the T in management team tends to be silent, right?
Okay.
So it's not well developed. Most management teams aren't in fact teams. They don't really get after it together. If they did, that would really make a big difference. Yeah. And that's essentially the thing that I do. So by creating real teams out of management teams, I like to say I help to create a world of work that we want our kids to live in. That's my main driver in life. That's what I like to do.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful, I think. I mean, I'm wondering, I've asked this question before in other episodes as well, but I had an image when I started in the adult workforce, where a leader is kind of in an ivory tower somewhere and they point and they say, okay, this is what you do. And people that do the work, they execute. Right now I'm thinking a leader is more of an example, more of someone that enables other people to do their thing and is there for advice and obviously piece of vision and I think leadership, but leadership is kind of vague sometimes there as well. What in your term makes a good leader then, or a good leadership team?
In my experience, it is both empathy, vision, proactiveness, support, and the realization that as a leader, you're supposed to go first, especially in today's day and age. The leadership style that you're referring to is a leadership style that was pioneered in the European armies of about 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And there it made perfect sense because there you were on the hill looking at the troops slaughtering each other. So you had to have the grand overview. We later called that the helicopter view, right? When we actually had helicopters to do this.
Yeah.
But it's like a big field of play, battle, and you command from behind the lines.
Yeah.
Modern armies don't work that way at all. They do have a command center.
Yeah.
So there is somebody there planning the things that need planning. But the modern leaders, they go with their teams. They go first. And I like to look at the military for the most cutting edge leadership styles, because all the special forces, they're led that way.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that all the commanders, they go through the doors first, right? So there are door kickers and there are people like telling them where to go.
Yeah.
But it is much more hands-on, much more of a team effort than we think, because we've stopped studying that. So we're about 200 years behind in our leadership style in most modern organizations that use the military's structure of, well, yesteryear.
Yeah.
A modern style is almost always much more hands-on, much more empathetic even, and vision-driven. So modern missions are essentially, I have this problem, want you to go fix this, get a team together and roll.
Yeah.
Right. So present me a plan because I do want to pitch in a little bit.
Yeah.
But the plan is only there to structure the mind. We all know that the minute we go there, the plan is going to be different.
Yeah.
But the act of planning sharpens the mind.
Exactly.
That's something that I also take into my consulting. So planning, nothing wrong with it. Thinking that you stick to the plan, complete stupidity.
Which sounds like a paradox, right? But that initial planning probably helps you challenge the initial idea a bit more.
Interestingly, in the military, there's this famous quote from Eisenhower, you know, that's not like a modern day general.
Yeah.
In World War II, he already said, no plan survives contact with the enemy. The other thing he said was, the plan is worthless, but planning is essential. So it's the act of planning that is really necessary.
Yeah.
The result of the plan is essentially, you can just throw that away the minute you have planned.
Yeah.
That tends to freak out people a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But that is why, in, for example, Scrum, you create a plan every day. That's what the daily Scrum is for. What's the plan for today? That's the main question. That could be the entirety of it, right? So what's the plan for today for us to work together as a team to get to the goal that we've set ourselves? That's a really good question. And then every 2 weeks or whatever your sprint length is, you ask essentially the same thing. What's going to be the plan for the coming 2 weeks?
Yeah.
And then if you're into scaling frameworks, you probably ask a similar question every quarter. And then if you're in a business, you are likely to ask a similar question every 12 to 18 months or so.
Yeah.
But then if you're doing it well, at a higher level. So consciously, not at the lowest level, not completely broken down into work items. And funnily, because I said I was a recovering project manager.
Yeah.
In project management, originally, it was hammered home that you should do product-based planning, never work. So that means product breakdown is good.
Yeah.
Work breakdown is evil.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's fun. That's somehow that got lost.
Yeah.
And it got lost already in project management because it's literally in there in Prince 2 and in the PM Bach and those kinds of frameworks that, I mean, 20 years ago were all the rage. but the product-based planning is what do I need delivered? What problems do I need solved? That's what we plan for. Not how to do it,
okay.
But what's the structure of solving this problem?
Yeah.
And then as it comes to a team, the team then figures out how to solve those problems. We've essentially put those problems through a blender. They've become micro problems, smaller things to solve.
Yeah.
We ask a team, how would you solve this? How much time would be involved? And they figure out what the work breakdown is, but only when we've decided this, and this micro problem are the ones that we needed to fix.
Yeah.
That was how project management was intended to go. And of course, we all know that was not what happened. Mm-hmm. But in Agile, it's essential. And funnily, it's still the same message. Do product-based planning, not work item-based planning.
Exactly.
And if you keep that in mind, it's also real easy to match up an agile approach with a more classical mindset in companies. So that's one of the things I use heavily. I go in, talk to the PMO or whatever kind of project management they have going and explain this to them. This is going back to the fundamentals of project management and really getting it right in a short cycle environment.
Exactly. I'm just thinking that, I mean, right, we have different varying scales of organizations. But the bigger the scale, the more little places it can go wrong, right? Instead of product planning, you can do work item planning. You can get a solution already described to you and not even a problem as an engineer, for example. And then you're going to ask questions and that's going to create friction, more conversations. There's lots of levels where it can already go wrong. And as you mentioned, if let's say that upper level management needs to be kind of empathetic and really relate to the people that do the work, then how can you always have that middle management layer, right? Because how does it work in kind of a traditional hierarchical setting then? I'm assuming it doesn't.
Exactly. It doesn't really, especially because middle management, they have the toughest job of all because they tend to have upper management that just says, make the numbers.
Exactly.
And then they also say, but do it in an agile way, right? Because we do want you to make the numbers, but to do it twice as fast in half the time and like, for less money, which is like that's like the definition of a mission impossible.
Yeah.
That only works if upper level management understands that empathy goes both ways, right? So you give somebody an assignment like that, you have to understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And you also have to give them different numbers, a range of numbers to begin with, but also the real target behind the numbers. Mm-hmm. You need to know why that's being asked of you. Usually middle management doesn't get that luxury. Only the really smart ones, they eke it out of upper management.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that make promotion. So before you know it, you have middle management that has been taught to just execute and to structure and manage. And now some consultant comes in, usually hired by the upper level managers and essentially destroys your world, takes away your control. What's the most logical response to that? It's resistance.
Yeah.
And that's not the mistake of the middle management because just like you... if you're doing it well, would never insult a developer or a programmer or tester or because you're not getting this and you're doing it wrong. You should also not do that with middle management. Mm. They get it perfectly, but they know that to survive, they can't but act like this.
Yeah.
And therefore, the real question is what makes for this system to be a system where you have to act like this?
Yeah.
And every company I've seen where they tackled that question, really, middle management became like a breath of fresh air.
Okay.
And most of them want that.
Yeah.
Most managers I know, they would much rather really collaborate with their teams as opposed to just giving them orders.
Yeah.
Giving orders is lame and it doesn't work. And everybody knows that.
Yeah. I'm wondering how you do that because I'm assuming people can take it very much personally, right? You come in as a consultant.
Yes.
You're already an outside force. What do you know? That's kind of the first thought in their head probably. And then you're changing kind of what they're doing in a day-to-day thing. You can say, obviously, like, it's not you, it's the process, and we need to change the process. But how do you, I think it requires a distinct way of communicating.
Yes.
And making people realize that there's a fundamental issue and that everything should change for the better. If you feel like it's not, let's talk about that. How do you do that?
Well, the best way to explain how I do that is by explaining what I don't do. Mm. I never go in and tell them they're doing a bad job.
Yeah.
I never go in and tell them you're just not getting Scrum, right? Or just stick better to the process, because if you did this well, it would have the results that that's wrong by having done it wrong in the past, right? So that's how I learned. The main thing I do is I just explain to them, this is how the system is supposed to work.
Yep.
This is why that works. And then I just ask them. Now knowing, actually run a liberating structure exercise with all the executives I coach.
Yep.
So probably that's how I currently do that. I explain to them what it is, why it works. I test them with some questions on their understanding of the process.
Yeah.
Usually they are very capable individuals, so they do understand why it would work.
Yeah.
And they also get this nagging feeling, but it won't work here because of whatever reason. And then I just ask, okay, so now knowing what it is and why it works and how you should do it, just create a big list of anything you can do to really screw it up. Mm. That's question number one. And question number two would be, okay, so if you're honest, which of these things are you actually doing?
Yeah.
Most management teams, they're able to like shift everything to the right. Right. Yeah. So all the things we could possibly think of how to do this wrong, we're actually doing as an organization.
Really?
Sometimes even individually.
Yeah.
So then my main thing is, okay, so now knowing that we're doing our absolute best for this not to be a success, do you really want this? Because then you need to solve all these problems.
Yeah.
Or do you actually need something else? Because there's even companies that we as Xebia were asked to come in and help them become more agile.
Yeah.
That honestly, I felt like you're doing Waterfall almost perfectly.
Yeah.
And it's delivering exactly what you need. So why are you changing? Mm-hmm. Just because everybody else is doing it? That's the worst reason. Right?
Yeah.
And I think that we would do well to also include that in the whole package, right? So sometimes just sit down with the client and talk and say, why do you really want to go agile? What result are you after?
Exactly.
Because going agile should never be the goal.
Exactly. It should always solve a problem that you're having.
Yes.
And I love that you're saying it is not the silver bullet, right? It's not a perfect world. There are no golden solutions out there. There's a guideline and it might work for your organization or something else might work. So let's figure out why, right? Really, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Mm-hmm. Can it help in the first place? And if so, I love that you say we just come up with a list of problems we need to solve, because these are the things that are holding us as an organization back in the first place.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like to always make a little bit of a joke with a silver bullet thing.
Yeah.
Because Agile is a silver bullet and it's really awesome and it works. The silver bullets are only useful when you're hunting werewolves, right? So are we actually hunting werewolves here or are we doing something else?
Yeah.
And that is a question not often asked.
Yeah. Yeah. You need to see a werewolf first. I'm going to keep that in mind.
Do we really have the problem that's being solved by this?
Exactly.
And sometimes the answer is no.
Yeah. I want to zoom in on the team building that you do in kind of those leadership levels, because I think team building, I'm an engineer, team building in my team, for example, on the more day-to-day stuff is already hard. But I think leaders already got to that position by doing things and by making choices and probably making some right choices, because otherwise they wouldn't be leaders in the first place. But then now all of a sudden they need to rely on others. There needs to be a certain level of trust. They need to cooperate. But I think your past history would make you think that, I mean, the choices you've made makes you belong here, makes you be here in the first place. So I think there might be a lot of friction already there in that upper level management team.
Yeah. Yeah. There, you first need to make people aware that they need to act as a team. That they have a problem that's big enough for it to need a team.
Yeah.
You can't chunk it down and say, you're responsible for that. You're responsible for that. Now go fetch and it'll all be fine.
Yeah.
Most leaders already know this, right? So they know that if I really do this and I'm not taking into account the targets of others, then I won't get anything done.
Yeah.
So most of them feel the need to collaborate and cooperate. To take that to the next level is to actually become a team. Now, this is actually as hard as it is in any other team as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Because if you just bunch some data scientists together or some programmers or some testers or whomever, and you just tell them you're a team now, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So that doesn't work either for management teams. You can't just say you're a management team, go fetch.
Figure it out. Yeah.
The thing that makes a team is a common goal. Mm. That's also why it's hammered home so much in Scrum and why it's also the single problem in most Scrum teams. Not a clear product goal, not a clear sprint goal, but also not a clear team goal.
Yeah.
Why does it seem exist? Management teams should have a crystal clear organizational goal and a personal goal. This is why we are a management team. This is what we think is important. And therefore, we collaborate to achieve that goal.
Yeah.
The minute you're there, you're almost done.
Okay.
As a coach. Because when that goal has been set and people really subscribe to it, then they start to act accordingly and they start to project that they're a team. And that in and of itself is a powerful force.
Yeah.
Because now they're speaking with one voice and they're clearly going towards an objective.
Yeah.
And before you know it, the whole organization starts, the part of the organization that working for this management team starts to see, oh, we're going there. That's actually the simplest way to project a vision. So yeah. Have only one. Because what happens mostly is you have like five managers in a management team. They all have their different targets and objectives.
Yeah.
And they might not be completely aligned because, well, nobody paid any attention to that.
Yeah.
And so they're going in different directions. And how what that looks like if you're going in like exactly a different direction, that's no movement.
No. It will be a split focus across exactly. The organization as well.
And that happens to the teams as well. And the teams then become logically very, very cynical about yeah. Their management, even though management is doing their best.
Yeah.
But management as an individual can never do their best if they don't work as a team.
Yeah.
Of course, that's a conviction, right? So I do know that there are effective managers who go solo.
Yeah.
And those tend to be the managers that look me in the eye and say, if I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. But those tend to be the organizations where agile actually doesn't work.
Right? Yeah.
Because they have really dominant leaders.
Exactly. Where it's my way or the highway.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, sometimes that's necessary. So it as a leader, you must be able to dominate. So I'm not saying that's bad all the time.
Yeah.
But as an agile leader, it's probably way better to mostly not have to.
Yeah.
To really just say, okay, so what's holding you back from doing the best work of your life? And then solving whatever comes out of that. Like any answer is a problem to solve.
Yeah. If the issue is that there's a lack of kind of a shared goal in that upper management level, is it then that people don't realize it, that goal is missing?
No.
Or is it hard to formulate that goal in the first place?
When I started doing this work at that level, yeah. I thought that it was something that they needed to be taught.
Mm.
And boy, was I wrong. Because they all know this, right?
Okay.
Management usually are pretty smart people.
Yeah.
And they know this. They know the problem that they're struggling with. So usually what I need to do is go all the way back to the person hiring me, which usually is yet another level up.
Yeah.
And saying, look, the reason that these teams are not really working is because that's not a team. And the reason that that's not a team is because of you. That's the hard part of my work. Because usually then the first response is, yeah, that's what all the other consultants told me as well. So goodbye.
So
I need to figure out a way to tell it to them. Most of them already know this as well. So I need to make it okay for them to say that out loud.
Yeah.
That requires coaching, essentially. So I've read up on really pro-level coaching, and I'm doing a little bit of that. I'm not saying I'm a pro-level coach.
Yeah.
But I do know how to sustain a coaching conversation.
Yeah.
And that's what I use on executives.
Yeah. I love that when they hire you, right, to go solve a problem, they basically put you into a position and you're already looking straight ahead. You might turn around and say, well, actually, this might be the problem instead.
Yes. Well, that's actually an anti-pattern. I never do that anymore because then they fire you immediately.
Yeah.
So it's really good to first try and then come back armed with data. Right. So yeah. I've seen this. This is what happens. This is how it all ties back to you. So now I'm back. Like I told you on day one, but I told them really politely.
Sure.
So yeah. I'm not saying you're the problem. Right?
Exactly.
I'm saying, look, I've been here for 2 months. This is what I'm seeing. And it all ties back to you. So you could fix this. Mm. You could fix it today.
Yeah.
Shall we do that? And then it becomes an invitation. So again, invitation over implementation.
Yeah.
I invite them to take the right step, the right action. And I make that really easy. That's my job.
Yeah. Sounds like a lot of trial and error because they don't teach you this in a lot of places, I feel like.
No, I've essentially failed for 21 years and now I think I may have gotten it.
Yeah, I love that.
And that only means that maybe today I'm going to get a call from an angry client, because that's life, right? So this is actually pretty tough to do.
Yeah.
But what really helped me take it to the next level was the realization that management is not like this like esoteric thing and only really weird people can do it. Managers are humans.
Yeah.
And that is something that's lost on a lot of people working for them.
Yeah.
But they really are. They're just like you and me. Actually, I also used to be a manager way back when, so I knew this already. Mm. But it was really good that I rediscovered that and just connect with people, not with managers.
Yeah.
And then talk about the job they do, which just happens to be management. If you do it in that order, almost all managers I talk with are pretty great people.
Yeah.
And actually easier to talk to than you may think.
Exactly. You destroy kind of the hierarchy or the position they have, and you just talk human to human, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and actually without destroying the position or the hierarchy, right?
So not necessarily destroying it, but making it non-existent in that conversation.
Yeah. Not as much of an issue.
That. Yeah.
So I'm talking to you because you hired me. That's another thing that I steal that from Serge Beaumont.
Okay.
He tends to go in, and then when people ask him, what are you doing here? You're just sipping tea and having great conversations.
Yeah.
Why aren't you making me more agile? And he tends to say, well, I'm not here to make you more agile.
Yeah.
And then they're like, what? But that's explicitly in your statement of work. I say, well, I'm here because you wanted to go agile.
Yeah.
And you hired me to help you do it. So I'm not here to convince you that it's a great idea.
Exactly.
Apparently you were already convinced. Shall we have a conversation about what you could do this week to take that one step further?
Yeah.
And that is, I think that was golden advice to me when he gave it. And that's what I really practice.
Yeah. Yeah. You're helping other people do what they want to do, right? They don't want to do
it. And the minute I discover it, they don't really want to do it. I just ask them, why don't you want to do it? This is what I see you do. Doesn't gel with taking the whole organization there. So apparently something's holding you back. What's holding you back here?
Yeah.
And more often than not, that's actually a good reason that they don't come up with. It's because we can't because of these legal reasons, or we can't right now because I don't have people who would like to do this. And again, forcing people to work in a certain way never really works. So that's a perfect reason to either slow down or maybe not go agile at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of, I still have kind of a last thought lingering in my head. Let's say an organization adopts Scrum, right? But it's implemented very top down, and you're in one of those teams. You're like, okay, this is kind of the cadence. We're doing daily stuff. We have some rituals here and there, but there's a lot of resistance from my teammates, et cetera, et cetera. How can you make that shift into the better, right? Make mm-hmm. them or convince them?
I think that depends on the country you're in.
Yeah.
And let me explain why. Mm-hmm. In the Netherlands, it's quite common to see a directive from up high as an interesting contribution to the conversation,
right?
In most other countries, that is a demand and you have to meet it.
Yeah.
So what I did for a pretty large Dutch organization that did exactly that, like top-down forced agile implementation. One of the teams, they did the type of work that you wouldn't normally have a Scrum team do.
Yeah.
So they were kind of fighting this and annoyed by the fact that they had to do Scrum. and they were whining about it, but really, right? So they were really being childish about it, but they had a point.
Okay.
So I hosted a Scrum whining session. I even called it that.
Yeah.
Some people were really unhappy with me calling it that. and I said, well, just have at it.
Yeah.
What do you hate about Scrum? And they essentially put a whole whiteboard full of sticky notes with everything they hated about it.
Yeah.
And this was a good result. And they were like really grinning at me. Like,
look at this.
Let's see it. Let's see you talk yourself out of this one, you slick agile coach, you.
Yeah.
And then I grinned and I said, well, I know what you're thinking. So let me see yourself talk out of this one. Here is the Scrum guide. It's only 13 pages.
Yeah.
So just go through the Scrum guide. And whenever you see something that's on that board, that's actually in here, put it on that paper right there.
Yeah.
So they did that. And after like 15 to 20 minutes, really fighting over the sticky notes and discussing this, they had maybe put 10 items on a separate flip chart.
Yeah.
And then I said, good. So now for the big reveal, management is demanding that you do Scrum. Mm. And from what you thought was Scrum, only 10 of the things you hate doing are actually on that list.
Yeah.
That means that anything that's left on that board is not Scrum. And I always pause for effect.
Yeah.
Because I've done this more than once.
Bum, bum,
and then they look at me like, okay, so what does that mean? I say, well, okay, so let me repeat this. Management wants you to do Scrum. Of the part of the work that you hate, all of that is not Scrum.
Yeah.
Only that is. And then usually somebody starts grinning. You're saying we only need to do those 10 things and suffer through them. And those 90 things that are there, we can just stop doing them. So, well, if management really wants you to do Scrum, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's always also the day that I'm fired from my assignment. But it's a really important remark for those teams because now it's their thing. And
exactly.
That's what Scrum is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be management's thing. It's supposed to be your thing.
Yeah.
And it isn't lots of rules. It's only a few rules.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is optional.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't serve you, don't do it.
Exactly. I think that is the best way. And I might just use that probably in the future. I'll re-listen to this episode. Thank you for coming on, Lawrence.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
I learned a lot.
Which I had a blast.
Yeah, you did?
Yeah.
Awesome.
It was awesome.
We'll do this again then in the future. Cool. Lawrence Ponoma, everyone.
Beyond Coding. From your sponsors, Zebia, creating digital leaders.